It is Friday, December the 18th. This is VOA's International Edition. Many thanks for joining us. Coming up, could deadly Russian airstrikes in Syria backfire on Moscow?
It's possible. And what's fascinating about this is the recent Russian intervention came, as, of course, together with the notion that they would be working hand-in-hand with the Iranians.
By the way, it's actually December the 21st. Also ahead, Israel allegedly assassinating a top Hezbollah official in the halftime entertainment at American football's Super Bowl. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Suspected Russian airstrikes killed dozens of people. It happened Sunday in the rebel-held city of Idlib in northwestern Syria. The British-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said most of those killed were fighters in the Army of Conquest. That's a rebel group fighting forces loyal to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. But rescue workers reported that six strikes had hit a busy marketplace in the city, several government buildings as well as residential areas. More than 150 people were wounded in those attacks. For some perspective now, VOA's Victor Beatty speaks with Jonathan Adelman of the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies, that's at the University of Denver, asking him if there is any sense the Russian airstrikes might be indiscriminate.
I think in this case they're deliberate, which is a terrible thing to say, but as we've noted before, there's kind of two aspects. The Russians in general, as the American military pointed out recently, isn't as precise under any conditions. But in this particular case, it seems part of their broader strategy. And that strategy is that they want to eliminate anybody who is opposing Bashar Assad, except for ISIS, to make it very clear that then that's the only choice for the West. They're going to have to go with Bashar Assad. So Idlib is controlled by the Army of Conquest, which is related to al-Qaeda and, of course, its offshoot, al-Nusra. And so the Russians are trying to eliminate it. And terror is not beyond the Russians' desire to do. They see all of this as terrible because Bashar Assad has been their loyal ally, and they have a naval base in Tartus. Now they have a second naval base. So they're prepared to do whatever they can. And if they kill a significant number of civilians, let's remember the sad part about this, that all sides have been killing civilians, but not as deliberately, but Bashar Assad's own forces have killed 250,000 of them. So unfortunately, this is not surprising, even if it's tragic, for the civilians.
Is this a strategy that carries some risk of turning the populace against the Russians?
Well, it's possible. And what's fascinating about this is the recent Russian intervention came, as, of course, together with the notion that they would be working hand-in-hand with the Iranians. And we've just seen statistics out that really call that concept into question. Because it turns out that Hezbollah, which has been busily fighting in Syria too, they've already lost up to 1,500 dead and 5,000 so seriously wounded there in hospitals. And the Iranians, who sent in, according to one study, came out this week, about 2,000 fighters, have now withdrawn 1,300 of their fighters. So that opens the obvious next question is, are the Russians getting into a cesspool from which they're not going to be able to get out because the Iranians and their offshoot Hezbollah have decided that this is a very dangerous place?
The Idlib city, of course, is strategically located. The advances bring the Syrian army just a few kilometers from the major rebel-controlled Aleppo-Damascus highway. Tell us how important that would be.
As you've suggested already, extremely important. Because the control of Aleppo, which is not really the second city, I mean, it is in terms of that it's not Damascus, but actually has more people than Damascus, is incredibly important to the outcome of this war. And so the Russians probably, we're just guessing here, because we obviously aren't talking to their commanders, but let's also remember two things. First of all, the Russians have not intervened with significant force. They've got about three dozen jets, which is not a whole lot. They've got a few thousand men that they've sent in. And I think what they're trying to do is, and they've got cruise missiles that they've been firing from as far as 1,000 miles away. Those have also been somewhat indiscriminate. So I think the Russians here are hoping to terrify the local population. And I think that shows something else. a kind of a lack of knowledge of what's been going on for the last 4 years, where the population has been so terrorized already that 4 million of them have left the country and another 6 to 7 million have had to relocate in other parts, suggests that the Russians want to empty that part of Syria of anybody who might possibly oppose them, which is a, you know, it's a horrible thought, but it's probably true.
Jonathan Adelman is an international studies scholar at the University of Denver and author of the book Global Threats. He was speaking with my colleague, Victor Beatty. Israel has allegedly assassinated a senior commander from the Lebanese guerrilla group Hezbollah. Robert Berger is in Jerusalem with our report.
Hezbollah says one of its top operatives, Samir Kuntar, was killed in an Israeli airstrike near the Syrian capital, Damascus. The group said two Israeli warplanes violated Syrian airspace and fired four long-range missiles at an apartment building. Kuntar was killed along with eight other people in the attack. In 1979, Kuntar carried out a notorious terrorist attack in Israel. He spent nearly 30 years in an Israeli prison before being released in a prisoner swap. Syrian Information Minister Omran al-Zoabi said the assassination is not the first time Israel has been involved in what he described as terrorist activity inside Syria. He accused Israel of collaborating with Saudi Arabia and Qatar in trying to topple the Syrian regime. Israel did not officially comment on the alleged assassination and stopped short of claiming responsibility. But Cabinet Minister Yuval Steinitz welcomed it. Steinitz said he does not know who carried out the attack, but no one should be sorry for the death of Kuntar, whom he described as a big criminal. Israeli security forces have raised their alert level on the northern border, bracing for possible Hezbollah retaliation. Robert Berger for VOA News, Jerusalem.
And still ahead, the rising number of displaced persons around the world.
One of the world's great cities, the gateway to America for generations. VOA brings you New York in 12 rarely seen views, presenting the 2016 VOA calendar, a gift from us free for the asking. Just send us your mailing address in an email to calendar@voanews.com, and you can have New York's beauty grace your wall all next year.
According to the UN Refugee Agency, this year likely will break all previous records as the year with the greatest number of people being forced to abandon their homes and become refugees and migrants. Alberto Pimienta has our story.
Nearly a million refugees have crossed the Mediterranean Sea so far this year, trying to find a safe and new beginning. Most of them are escaping conflicts in Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, and Somalia. The International Organization for Migration says Europe is facing its worst migrant crisis since World War II. The figures for this year will likely be four times more than 2014. According to the UN Refugee Agency's newest report, the global refugee population as of mid-2015 reached more than 20 million people for the first time since 1992. And the prospects for next year are not optimistic. 4,500 people flee their countries every day. The return rate for refugees is also at its lowest levels in three decades, making it unlikely many of them will return home anytime soon.
That was Alberto Pimienta reporting. Well, the refugee crisis and the terrorist attacks in Paris are fueling the rise of right-wing nationalist movements all across Europe, potentially undermining the unity of the European Union and its system of open borders, also known as Schengen. For some perspective, VOA's Carol Castiel speaks with Alina Polyakova, Associate Director of the Eurasia Center at the Atlantic Council, and Ivan Vedova, who is Senior Vice President of Programs at the German Marshall Fund of the United States. Here's Carol Castiel.
That's a very good question. Just recently, I actually wrote a piece particularly about this project and about what the European dream really means. And the European project at its core, I would argue, was about inclusive politics and about enlightenment and ideals and egalitarianism. This is what Schengen, as a symbolic system of political freedom of movement, actually symbolizes. So I think now what we're seeing is not a sudden backlash against the European Union. In fact, this backlash has been building. I mean, the right-wing backlash. So even though right-wing parties, particularly Le Pen's National Front, is in the news now, these parties have been becoming part and parcel of European politics for quite some time, and particularly since the economic crisis of 2008. And I think at its core, what this has to do with is with a real crisis of identity within Europe today. What we've seen the European project be very successful at is economic integration and political integration, but has not been very successful at cultural integration. And specifically, this emergence of a European identity that would somehow supersede or transcend national identities has not come to fruition. And what we're seeing now, especially with the fact that younger people are flocking more and more to these populist right-wing groups, is that people are seeking some sense of belonging. And the European Union has not been able to provide that. So I think if we're going to talk about a project in crisis, it's important for us to remember that it is really the cultural identity issues that are in crisis right now.
Turning to you, Ivan Vevoda, for your take on whether or not the European project is in peril.
Well, the project is certainly being most severely challenged in all of its history since the post-World War II. I'd like to add to what Alina said that at origin, the European project is emphatically a political peace project. How does Europe avoid doing war every 20, 25 years? And that is really what galvanized the effort to institutionalize relations, to create buffers so that Europeans, French, and Germans did not need to go to war every few years. And it has been successful during the Cold War. Let's remind ourselves that it was able to do this because of the U.S. security umbrella. And thus, it did not have to invest into its military capacities because the U.S. was there to see that it could defend Europe against the communist Soviet bloc. I would add and really emphasize the economic aspect that Alina mentioned. I think the loss of certainty of the young generation, the fact that politicians do not know how to cope with a situation of rising unemployment and loss of future. So 18-year-olds, 19-year-olds turn to these kinds of parties who are offering typical populist right-wing or sometimes left-wing solutions.
Ivan Vedova is Senior Vice President of Programs at the German Marshall Fund of the U.S. He and Alina Polyakova, Associate Director of the Eurasia Center at the Atlantic Council, was speaking with Carol Castiel, host of the VOA program Encounter. You can hear more of their conversation by going to our website, voanews.com, and look under the Programs tab for Encounter. This is VOA.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Take your peek, watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio. Hello, I am Shaka Sali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from The Voice of America. Each Wednesday night, I'll put you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they, you and I, talk about the most important social and political issues in Africa. Shaka Sali saying, I'll be waiting for your call Wednesday night on Straight Talk Africa from The Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Rwanda's National Electoral Commission says practically every voter supports lifting term limits for President Paul Kagame. More than 98% of the voters in the referendum just voted upon chose to change the Constitution to allow Mr. Kagame to seek another term and potentially rule until 2034, Mr. Kagame's current term expiring in 2017. Emmanuel Semahora is a Kigali resident.
This constitution must be reviewed because there is some articles which which we need to review so that our president will be able to participate in next election.
It turns out if Mr. Kagame continues to win elections, he could stay in power, as I said earlier, to 2034. Here is President Kagame in an exchange with reporters.
Will you be standing for the next time? Are you going to make an announcement
we'll
yet?
We'll see when time comes.
Everyone thinks that's a foregone conclusion.
Maybe.
The U.S. and European Union say the amendments to the Constitution undermines democracy in Rwanda. An Air France flight was forced to make an emergency landing in Kenya after a suspicious device was found in a laboratory. Air France CEO Frederick Gagey said the device didn't present any danger to passengers and was a false alarm. The Boeing 777 was headed to Paris from Mauritius when a passenger noticed something that looked like a stopwatch mounted on a box. The passenger reported the device to the flight crew, who informed the pilots. The plane then made an emergency landing at an airport in the Kenyan city of Mombasa. All 459 passengers and 14 crew were safely evacuated. An international agriculture organization is calling on climate leaders to put women and youth at the forefront of their action plans to address climate issues. The CGR Research Program on Climate Change, Agriculture, and Food Security, also known as CCAFS, says just mentioning women and youth in the preamble to the recent climate agreement draft is not enough. Sophia Heyer is the Gender and Social Inclusion Research Leader for CCAFS. She spoke with VOA's Kim Lewis about the important role women play in climate issues and why they are a key component for food security.
Globally, women are heavily involved in agriculture at about 43% to 48%, according to the FAO. But in the developing world, their participation can be as much as 70%, 80%, 90%. Across the least developed countries, 79% of women cite agriculture as their primary economic activity. So that's the first thing. Women are crucially important in the developing world in agriculture, and they play all sorts of roles, you know, from planting to seeding to harvesting to marketing and to selling produce, you know, in the local market. Their production does tend to be for home use as well, so vegetable gardening around the homestead, but they also engage in other sorts of agriculture. So that's a huge issue right there, and what we found is that technical support, the advice, the extension, the resources, the credit, the training, all of that tends to go to men. Women's participation in extension programs and farmer schools, for example, is quite low. And in fact, there is such a large gender gap in agriculture in all of these areas that the FAO has said that if women farmers were to have equal access to these resources with men, so this would be resources of information, credit, services, extension, and training, as well as technology, in my view. I'm not sure if they actually say technology, but basically inputs for production. If this were as equal between women and men farmers, then the global production would increase by 2.54%, and the number of the hungry people in the world would decrease by 12 to 14%, or about 100 to 150 million. And as we know, climate change is going to be increasingly bring increasing stresses on agriculture and food security.
Do you think during the negotiation process that this was addressed to the limit that it should have been regarding gender and youth issues?
Not at all. You know, in general, gender and youth are brought in into the preamble, basically, acknowledging the rights development as well as gender equality, empowerment of women, and intergenerational equity. That's the only reference to youth that I can find. You may have found another one, but I can only find two mentions to gender equality and two mentions to intergenerational equity, and those are very, very general as kind of pre-discussions to the rest of the agreement. In terms of gender and agriculture, we did a review of the INDCs. CCAFS went through about 160 of the INDCs a few weeks before COP21, and we found that only 10 countries have referred to women in agriculture. So while there are more references to women in general and gender equality, not quite enough in my view, but more, there are only 10 recognizing the role of women as farmers. So that's a big gap.
So what needs to be done to make sure that there are gender-responsive climate policies and programs looking forward?
There needs to be the recognition of the roles that women play in agriculture and in other sectors that are being affected by climate change, in energy, in water management, in natural resource management. Most of the references to women and gender in the INDCs refer to women as vulnerable populations and the impacts on them, which is true. Women often are in the vulnerable populations, but so are men. And so it's not sufficient to say that women are in the vulnerable category. There needs to be much more recognition of the role that women play in all of these sectors, the importance of their contributions, and strategies to support them.
Sophia Heyer of the CIGAR Research Program on Climate Change, Agriculture, and Food Security. She was speaking with Kim Lewis, host of the VOA program, Africa News Tonight. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
An international team of researchers has found that climate change could worsen if large fruit-eating animals living in tropical forests should become extinct. After eating its fruit, the animals are known to scatter the seeds of large tree species in their waste material. The researchers say birds and large mammals are responsible for almost all dispersal of the seeds for large plants such as trees. These trees help counter climate change by capturing and storing a good amount of carbon dioxide before it has a chance to escape into the atmosphere. So, if the large animals are taken from an ecosystem, the researchers say it could lead to a loss in hardwood trees, which means more CO2, a primary greenhouse gas, winds up in the atmosphere. According to the researchers, a number of large animal species are currently being threatened by issues such as hunting, illegal trade, and habitat loss. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. You know, one of the biggest annual music events is seen by about a half billion people around the world, and it only lasts about 15 minutes. It's the U.S. National Football League Super Bowl halftime show. This year is also all abuzz because it is the 50th Super Bowl. VOA Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald speaks with my colleague Jim Stevenson about the unveiling of the headline act.
This is the golden anniversary Super Bowl, the 50th Super Bowl. So the National Football League is going to go all out. We now know who the headliner for the halftime show will be. It will be the English rock band Coldplay.
An interesting choice.
Yeah, Bruno Mars was the early favorite. And in fact, Bruno is going to be involved in this show. You might remember he put on a killer halftime show in 2014, right, along with his special guest, the Red Hot Chili Peppers. Well, the Latin Times reports that Bruno will curate this Super Bowl 50 halftime show, and I take that to mean that he will likely perform, and he will also bring a bunch of big-name guest stars. Now, Chris Martin, the lead singer of Coldplay, is good friends with Jay-Z and Beyoncé. Beyoncé, of course, was the headliner at the 2013 Super Bowl.
Right.
So she's got plenty of Super Bowl experience.
And some accused her of knocking the lights out in that game.
Well, you know, there is that possibility. And Beyoncé also shows up on Coldplay's brand new seventh album, A Head Full of Dreams. So if you put everything together, I think a clearer picture emerges of what we can expect. Super Bowl 50 happens on February 7th, 2016 at Levi's Stadium in Santa Clara, California. For the past few years, this has been the trend with Super Bowl halftime shows, multi-artist extravaganzas.
The NFL, in the wake of the Justin Timberlake and Janet Jackson wardrobe malfunction, likes to have these things tightly choreographed.
Well, they've loosened up a bit. You might remember that immediately in the wake of the 2004 wardrobe malfunction, they had a series of classic rock artists, people like Paul McCartney and Tom Petty. Prince was in there. They would be what you might call safe choices. Mm-hmm. Well, Coldplay is a safe choice, too. Most likely, they had Katy Perry last year. It's going to be a real extravaganza, though. I think they're going to pull out all the stops for this one. I think Coldplay will sort of be the eye of the hurricane, so to speak.
Absolutely. And they love to also have a lot of acts before the game as well for the fans. If you actually go to the game, there's a lot going on musically.
Yeah, they've come a long way. The earliest Super Bowls had college marching bands
right.
for their halftime entertainment.
Right, and who could forget Up With People?
Up With
yes,
People.
They did a couple halftime shows.
Way back in the 70s.
Yes.
I think the age of the modern Super Bowl halftime show began in 1993 when Michael Jackson was the feature performer.
I remember that one, and that was quite a spectacular. You can see that on YouTube, by the way, and, right. and looking at the old footage, wow, it's still a big halftime show.
Still holds up, and mm-hmm. things have never been the same since then.
Things that hold up here always is our Top 20 Countdown. We love to hear it every week. Ray McDonald is our host. Follow him on Twitter as well, Ray.
Ray on the hits.
That's all you need to know. Thanks for stopping by.
You got it, Jim.
Yeah, that's it. Hey, listen, you know, if you haven't seen that Michael Jackson performance from 93, you really should check it out on YouTube. It is spectacular. And just like they said, it holds up today. Coldplay, Bruno Mars, Jay-Z, Beyonce. It's going to be exciting in February, folks. One other story for you. The film Star Wars, The Force Awakens, ever heard of it? Well, how could you have missed? Has already surpassed the $238 million mark here in North America. And it's amazing. And about $500 million globally. This is just the first weekend for this event, setting all kinds of records. The Walt Disney Company behind the film said the film made an estimated $121 million just Thursday night. That's it. When it opened late Thursday night, it smashes previous opening day records, $91 million set by the 2011 film Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows. That was part two of that one. Amazing. Jurassic Park, unexpected movie sensation in June, also holds the global weekend opening record of $524.9 million. And it looks like this movie is going to exceed that. Listen, thanks for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Good to have you with us. Latest world news is straight ahead. And for our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Chaz Hall, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
President Barack Obama has said that strong, successful countries require strong and vibrant civil societies.
Human progress has been propelled not just by famous leaders, not just by states, but by citizens who are willing to stand up against incredible odds and great danger. Not only to protect their own rights, but to extend rights to others.
Syrian civil society activists and human rights defenders Razan Zaytuneh, her husband Wael Hamada, and her two colleagues, Samira Al-Halil and Nizam Hamadi, were four such citizens. As a passionate Syrian leader and one of the founders of the Violations Documentation Center and local coordinating committees, Razan played a critical role in documenting human rights violations and risked her life to advocate on behalf of political prisoners. A supporter of peaceful democratic reform and nonviolent civil resistance, she chose to stay in Syria after President Bashar al-Assad turned guns and tanks on peaceful anti-government protesters in 2011, and after the regime formally denounced her. Razan Zaytuneh detailed human rights abuses and the atrocities occurring in Syria. In 2013, Ms. Zaytuneh, her husband and two colleagues from the center, joined the ranks of the more than 10,000 people in Syria who have been forcibly disappeared since the conflict began. The four rights activists, now known as the Duma Four, were abducted from their office in Duma, a suburb of Damascus, in December 2013. Their whereabouts remain unknown, and no individual or group has claimed responsibility for their disappearance. On December 9th, U.S. State Department spokesperson John Kirby published a statement marking the two-year anniversary of their abduction. He called for the immediate release of the four activists and urged anyone with information about them to come forward to help ensure the safe return of these brave human rights defenders. We recognize Razan and the thousands of Syrian political prisoners and human rights activists who have defied brutality and oppression and fought for a democratic and pluralistic future, said Mr. Kirby. We stand with these courageous Syrians and reiterate our call that those responsible for serious human rights violations and abuses in Syria must be held accountable.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.